The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on this final program of the work week. Friday is already here. A busy news day, a historic meeting between North and South Korea going on, and President Trump's already had some things to say about that on Twitter and elsewhere. So lots of things happening. I touched on just some of the more positive stories about America and the Trump administration. I believe that was the first program of the week. So you can go back to that program or any of the programs that we have live every day. They're posted later as podcast at thetrumpet.com. Well, on today's show, we're going to be talking later on in the program about South Africa. It was on this day in 1994 that Nelson Mandela won the election as the first black president of South Africa. And of course, he's hailed today by many, particularly on the left, as one for, who was primarily responsible for dismantling the apartheid system. He died in 2014. He stepped down from office in 1999. He retired and then died in 2014. And as you might remember, the funeral brought in dignitaries from all over the world. It was quite an event. President Barack Obama, the U.S. president at the time, called Mandela the last great liberator of the 20th century. He liberated South Africa, or did he? We'll look at that later on in the program. First, though, we'll go through some of the news items that caught our attention today. This first one here, just as an update on the program we had yesterday about little Alfie Evans. It's from Sky News here, and it tells you some of the details that I went through yesterday about the High Court in Britain here deciding basically that that if Alfie is able to go home, he might be moved, but he's not going to be able to go to Italy. He's not going to be able to leave the country. His parents, this little two-year-old, they can't leave the country. It says here from Sky News that Gerard Tubb said the High Court had been told by a doctor treating Alfie that there would need to be a change in his family's attitude if Alfie is to be moved. So that's a doctor in the NHS system, an extension of the British government, saying that we're not going to let him go yet until there's a change in their attitude. He said Alfie's mother and father want to get him off of the ICU. The end-of-life plan is in place, and the hospital will now be managing it. So they're, like I said yesterday, they're the parents. They decide. And maybe they'll let him go home, but the parents need to change their attitude. They better change their attitude if they want their son back. It's just an unbelievable story on so many different levels. Go back and listen to yesterday's program. We posted that at thetrumpet.com. Just a side note here, the Key of David, I believe my father's program that's playing this weekend is a repeat from about a year ago, and it was following the shocking 2016, November 2016 presidential election. And my father in this program that plays again this weekend, he plugs Make America Great Again, his book from around the election of Donald Trump. And he talks in this program about how the president, and this is going back again to a program he taped a year ago, but he talks in there, as he does in the book, about how President Trump does a pretty good job of identifying a lot of world problems and addressing people's concerns. And, of course, one of his slogans was to make America great again. And my father goes through the history, some of it, of America and what made America great in the first place. So it really would tie in, I think, this program, this repeat, with even some of the things we've been discussing over the last couple of weeks on this program. I'll start here with Victor Davis Hanson again. He's the brilliant historian that really is concentrating more, it seems, on politics and the war between the right and the left. And in this case, as he writes this time, the double standard that you see going on with the Mueller investigation in particular. But he says that that could soon change. The country's about to witness an investigatory train wreck. In one direction, special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation train is looking into any conceivable thing that President Donald Trump's campaign team might have done wrong in 2016. So their investigation, it's a fishing expedition. But Hanson says here, the oncoming train is slower, but also larger. It involves congressional investigations, Department of Justice referrals, and Inspector General's reports, mostly focused on improper or illegal FBI and DOJ behavior during the 2016 election. So you have Mueller looking for anything that the Trump campaign and presidency might have done wrong. And then exactly as my father's been talking about, the more that this investigation goes on, you're seeing more and more lawlessness revealed. Lawlessness at the FBI. Lawlessness at the DOJ. He says, Hanson does, why are the two about to collide? He says, by charging former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn for lying to the FBI, Mueller emphasized that even the appearance of false testimony is felonious behavior. Even the appearance of false testimony. Okay, so if that's the standard, well then, what about others? He says, Hanson does, if that be so, then the DOJ will probably have to charge former Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe for or with perjury or related offenses. He's lied repeatedly to investigators. And Hanson then brings up James Comey, the former FBI director, and how that he may have lied to Congress when he said that he had not written his report on Hillary Clinton, the email scandal, before interviewing Clinton. We now know that he had written it. It was done months in advance. The Clinton interview, it was just all for show. The investigation was already wrapped up. Hanson says former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper and former CIA Director John Brennan lied under oath to Congress on matters related to surveillance. So if even the appearance of false testimony is a felony in the case of Mike Flynn, what about Jim Clapper? What about John Brennan? What about James Comey? What about Andrew McCabe? It says further on in this piece, Mueller is said to be investigating whether Trump obstructed justice by requesting that Comey go easy on Flynn. If so, then the DOJ will have to look at Comey, Comey himself, and DOJ officials who obstructed a federal court. Talks about the FISA applications and how that they didn't tell the whole story there. Comey also has said that he predicated the nature of the Clinton email investigation on the assumptions about her chances of winning the presidency. That's another investigatory abuse. It says the Mueller team is reportedly still looking into the possibility of election-style collusion with Russia by Trump officials. That track will require Mueller's DOJ counterparts to look carefully at the Clinton campaign, which paid opposition researcher Steele, a British subject, for dirt on Trump that was produced through collusion with Russian sources. So, and in every case, and we've made this point already before, but in every case where there's this accusation or this charge, there's guilt. There's evidence of guilt on the other side. Mueller is also said to be investigating whether Trump or his advisors broke laws concerning the release of confidential government information. If so, the DOJ may have to indict Comey. He confessed to passing along confidential FBI memos to a friend for the expressed purpose of leaking their contents to the press. And of course, the motivation for all of that, the leaking, was that he hoped there'd be a special investigation, a special counsel appointed, which ended up happening. President Trump alluded to this yesterday in his 30-minute interview with Fox News, an interview that all the major media members came out and said, this is how you know there was probably something in it that's worth listening to. They talked about it being a rant. He was angry. He was rambling. He was drunk. He was whatever. That's the left-wing media's approach to the story. CNN had a list of 53 of the most memorable lines. And of course, they mock, they ridicule. They've got a snide remark for every single one of the lines. This is what qualifies as news at CNN now. I mentioned yesterday a story from CNN, just the way that they approached the state visit from Macron, from France. But here is President Trump yesterday on Fox and Friends. This is the morning show that he's a big fan of, and he's on there talking about, well, I think it was Comey the night before. I'll play this clip in a moment as well, but the night before, Comey was on CNN talking about the information that he leaked, and as it happens, surprisingly, Anderson Cooper actually confronted him on this. But first, let me just play President Trump's comments on Comey, the leaker. Here's clip one.
Look, Comey is a leaker, and he's a liar. And not only on this stuff, he's been leaking for years. He's probably been using his friend, the so-called professor, who now turns out to have FBI clearance, which he never said. He even lied about that because he never said that in Congress. He said he gave it to a friend. And he gave it to a friend to leak classified information. It's all classified. It was totally classified. So he did an illegal act, and he said it himself, in order to get a special counsel against me.
So he leaked this classified information in order. That's a crucial point that the president points out there, and Victor Davis Hanson brings it out in his piece as well. But he leaked this confidential information that he had prepared on government time while he was still at the FBI. I know, again, all that he says now is that, well, by the time I leaked them, I was a private citizen, it wasn't classified, and so on and so forth. But in actual fact, he leaked classified memos or information, confidential exchanges with the president, which, as the president also said in that interview, a lot of the details he got wrong. But he did it. He was justified in doing it in order to get the special counsel investigation going against Trump. Against Trump. And so that's what's happened. And that's what's been going on for the past year. And now, of course, over the last couple of weeks, and we've hammered at this quite a lot, but over the last couple of weeks, Comey's come out with his book. He's on tour. He's sold, I think, something like a million copies already. So he's making a ton of money on this particular project, this tell-all book. And there's a few that will stand up to him here. Here was a surprising exchange between Comey and Anderson Cooper of CNN about leaking those memos. Clip five.
But you did leak memos. I mean, is it okay for somebody at the FBI to leak something, an internal document, even if it's not classified? Isn't that leaking?
Well, there's a whole lot wrong with your question, Anderson. First, I didn't leak memos. I asked a friend to communicate the substance of one unclassified memo.
Can I finish for a second? Sure, okay.
One unclassified memo to the media, and I was really important. I was a private citizen. I was not an FBI employee at that time.
But it was an internal document. It was a document you had written while you were FBI director. That is a leak. I mean, if you tell somebody, don't give them the document, but tell them what's in the document, that's still a leak, no?
Well, not to get tangled up in it, I think of a leak as an unauthorized disclosure of classified information.
Really? That's it? That's a leak.
That's how I thought about it as FBI director. We investigated leaks, so unauthorized disclosures.
In your memo, when you said that when the president said he was eager to find leakers and would like to nail one to the door as a message.
I said that.
Shouldn't you be nailed to the door then? I mean, aren't you a leaker? Aren't you a leaker? I mean, you gave up a document that was released to the New York Times, information from that document released to the New York Times. I know you say it's not classified, but plenty of people leak non-classified information to reporters, and the White House and the FBI gets upset about it.
The FBI gets upset when people make unauthorized disclosures of protected information. There was nothing protected about this. It wasn't classified. It wasn't privileged.
So when you were FBI director,
it's also in my book.
So when you were FBI director, if somebody on your team had given a friend documents that they were writing that you were involved with and said, oh, you could just tell the New York Times what's in this document, you wouldn't have had a problem with that?
Well, depending on what was in the document.
So he decides, in other words. Well, I mean, I decide whether or not I should leak it or not. And if I leak it, it's not really a leak. The president came out and tweeted about this, I think, just this morning. It's astounding what's going on. He can't even define really what a leak is. And he was the head of the FBI. He was leaking classified information. And then he says somehow that it's not a leak because, well, I just gave the gist of it to a friend of mine. And we now know a lot more about the friend. But as the president said on Fox News yesterday, I mean, this was all set up. This was the pretext for the entire investigation against the Trump presidency. These memos, this confidential information that was leaked by the director of the FBI. He can say that, well, at the time I leaked it, I wasn't the director. I was just a regular old citizen. But this was the FBI. This was the DOJ during the Obama years. And like Victor Davis Hanson brings out in his article, they all thought, and Comey's admitted as much, they all were operating in a world in which Hillary Clinton was going to win the election in November of 2016. And even the email investigation was based on that assumption. The American Spectator, it had a piece this week as well about those comments that Devin Nunes said that there was nothing. I mean, even before the Mueller investigation, as we now know, they were spying on Trump. They were spying on the Trump candidacy, the Trump administration. And Nunes came out and said that spying was based on no intelligence. Here again, it's just a fishing expedition. Spectator says the Obama administration's decision to spy on the Trump campaign was not, in Susan Rice's words, by the book, but scandalously irregular. And these are the facts that are now turning up. All of this scandalous behavior. And as Victor Davis Hanson says, it's only a matter of time before even these departments are going to have to say, well, okay, if this one's being prosecuted based upon this crime, well, what about these others that are being investigated by, you know, congressional hearings or by an inspector general? It says here, it turns out, according to Congressman Devin Nunes, that not even a semblance of official intelligence justified the spying. It was a probe from nowhere to nowhere, undertaken simply to satisfy the partisan hunches of John Brennan and other Trump haters in the Obama administration. They were all working, you see, behind the scenes, pushing for this. They were all in cahoots. They all hated Trump. They all loved Hillary. They were all Obama people. Switching back to Victor Davis Hanson, he says, Mueller has searched far and wide for wrongdoing, but so far has found little. Meanwhile, there's plenty of other wrongdoing already found, but no one seems to be looking at it. Flynn, Cohen, and other Trump aides are considered small enough fry to go after. Clinton, Comey, McCabe, and others seem big enough fry to leave alone. And as he brings out here, though, no one thought Hillary would lose. No one thought she would lose. And so they were going on with their lawlessness. They were carrying on with all of their lawless acts, knowing that once Hillary won, well, the status quo would be in place, and they could continue on with these abuses of power, attacking their political enemies. It says the more, this is the conclusion of Victor Davis Hanson, it says the more Mueller searches for hypothetical lawbreaking, the more he is inadvertently underscoring that actual lawbreakers must be subject to the same standard of justice. Here again, keep thinking of the title of that recent article by my father. Saving America from the Radical Left. Saving America from the Radical Left. Temporarily, yes. But what would have happened had Trump not pulled out the victory? He says here, ironically, Mueller's investigation has reminded America that it is past time to call Comey, McCabe, and a host of Obama-era DOJ and FBI officials to account. For over a year, we've had two standards of legality when there can only be one. A reckoning is near. That's Victor Davis Hanson talking about the soon coming day of reckoning. And look, a lot of this might come out into the open more just because of the lawsuit that the Democrats have filed about this. The way they see it, they still are on this illegal conspiracy between Trump, the Trump campaign, Russia, the Russian government, WikiLeaks. At the Federalist, it says, central to the conspiracy was the purported hacking by the Russian government of the DNC's computers and the dissemination of the hacked emails to harm Hillary Clinton's candidacy. That happened back in, I think it was July of 2016. Remember, the DNC was hacked. 20,000 emails, all of these embarrassing revelations that it was Hillary Clinton in collusion with the DNC to win the nomination, to cheat, basically, so that Bernie Sanders wouldn't get it. That was going on behind the scenes. And that was made known by those emails that were revealed by WikiLeaks in the summer of 2016. Federalist says it was hung as a case on the alleged Russian hack. Since this is central to its theory of liability, it is going to have to prove by a preponderance of evidence, the level of proof in civil cases, that the Russians did the hacking and shared the results with the Trump campaign. On the other hand, the defendants are now able to legally test and challenge that claim. And so what this article is pointing out is what others have also noted already, in that if they're going to go after this and take legal action to go after Trump, they open themselves up at the same time to discovery and depositions. I mean, this is something that we can identify with well in this church, because it was the Worldwide Church of God that came after us back in 1997. And you, if you've read Raising the Ruins, I mean, you know the history there. You know what they were doing following the death of Mr. Armstrong. They were lying. They were deceiving. They were cheating. They were doing all of those things. And then as our work grew and as we needed more and more of Mr. Armstrong's writings to give to interested people, people who heard the message and wanted to learn the teachings of God, well, we printed Mystery of the Ages. That's what Mr. Armstrong wanted. He wanted it to go to the largest audience possible. Well, and then in comes the Worldwide Church of God, all these threats. You stop, decease and desist from doing that. Cease and desist. Stop that now. Don't send out that material. We're taking you to court. And they did do that, but they opened themselves up. Were it not for that court lawsuit, we wouldn't have the information we needed for Raising the Ruins. And it's like my father said there toward the end of that litigation. We not only want the 18 works, we want the discovery so that we can produce a 19th work, which became Raising the Ruins. And that really exposes them. I mean, we knew it anyway. Malachi's message brings it out. I mean, Malachi's message in that book, it was prophesied. We knew there was a man of sin right at the top. We knew there was an unlawful Joshua. We knew it was the Laodicean era. We knew that the whole church had gone lukewarm. And so, in a lot of ways, I mean, you knew what was going on. At least if you were reading our literature, you knew what was going on internally as early as 2013, halfway through the Obama presidency. I mean, you knew before that if you just were opening your eyes to all of those associations that he had, like I covered this week as well, the associations that Barack Obama had with communists and so on, Marxist professors. But then when the discovery was turned over, you got it in all of the internal memos, and they didn't even realize what they were giving us. They didn't even realize what it was exposing. It exposed the web of lies. It'll be interesting if the DNC pursues this. It'll be interesting what it turns up. It talks here in this Federalist piece about that DNC hack in July of 2016. It says here, assuming the case survives a motion to dismiss for failure to state a valid legal claim, the DNC has just opened itself up to civil discovery by the defendants, who can now compel the production of documents and other physical things and take the depositions of DNC officials, employees, associates, candidates, operatives, and others. In short, the DNC has just invited the defendants to pursue its most deeply held secrets. They're going to have to start turning them over. He talks then about the DNC hack, 20,000 emails. Much to the embarrassment of Hillary Clinton, the released files showed the DNC had secretly collaborated with her campaign to promote her candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination over that of Bernie Sanders. If there's a story about cheating your way to an election, this is it. And it was revealed in July of 2016. And it embarrassed the Clinton campaign. And now they're taking that and turning it on Trump, saying that Trump was behind this along with the Russians because, well, the Russians hacked into us. It says, when the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI learned of the hacking claim, they asked to examine the server, and the DNC refused. Think about that. They had just been hacked. They were upset about it. The FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, comes in. I mean, this is a big deal. The Russians hacked into the DNC? They come in, they ask to look at the server, and the DNC says, no, you can't do that. We can't turn those over. Just take our word for it. We were hacked. It was by the Russians, and obviously President Trump or Donald Trump was in on it. He's our enemy. President Trump, by the way, brought this back to light yesterday in that interview with Fox News. Listen to this, clip 3.
The only collusion is the collusion with the Democrats and the Russians. You take a look at what's going on there. They wouldn't even give their server, the DNC, Democratic National Committee, wouldn't even give its server to the FBI. So what kind of an FBI? They break down doors for Paul Manafort early in the morning. His wife is in bed, like at 5 or 6 in the morning. And they undo the lock for Michael Cohen early in the morning. And yet they walk into the DNC and they won't give them the server. They say, we're not giving you the server. Oh, okay, we'll leave. That's not the FBI. That's a fix.
That's a fix. That was the FBI in 2016 under the direction of James Comey. Walking into the DNC headquarters saying, well, let us look at the server so we can get to the bottom of this. No can do. Why wouldn't they want them to look at the server? What are they hiding? What are they concealing? Well, in this Federalist piece, it refers to a number of other stories that have come out since. that are drawing attention to the fact that a lot of people are saying it was an inside job. It was someone who stole the files on the inside, perhaps a Bernie Sanders supporter who was unhappy with what happened. It says, in the course of discovery, the defendants, well, it goes on and talks about what sorts of things could turn up if this does, in fact, play out. But some of the things that the Federalist brings out is that this could all just be a setup, even going back to the DNC hacking. It could all be a setup from day one, which is why they've been so careful not to release their information. I guess I can read some of this. It says, similarly, they should have the DNC files released by Guccifer 2.0 analyzed to determine if they were altered to give the false impression that the Russians had hacked the server. If so, who was responsible for the adulteration? If, as appears likely, the server was not hacked, why did Hillary Clinton and the DNC claim that it was? Defense counsel should also investigate whether the DNC files were stolen by someone who had direct access to the DNC server. In that regard, who at the DNC had a motive to leak the files? Finally, since the DNC has alleged collusion by the defendants with Russia, then the Steele dossier, the very genesis of the Trump-Russia collusion story, should be open for investigation. Hillary Clinton, whose campaign funded the production of that dossier, along with the DNC, would be a likely deponent, along with Glenn Simpson of Fusion GPS, Steele, Sidney Blumenthal, and others who have reportedly been involved in composing the salacious and unverified contents of the dossier. More and more facts turning up, proving, as my father said, in Saving America from the Radical Left, proving the lawlessness, the lies, the deceit at the very highest levels of the DOJ, the FBI, all of these agencies stocked full of Obama appointees. President Trump, in that interview yesterday, he talked about, well, they asked him. You know, he criticized the DOJ, the FBI, for not going after Comey and all these crimes. And the Fox people in that interview said, well, I mean, it's your department. It's your DOJ. So basically, like, why don't you get in there and start firing people? Listen to what he said. This is clip two.
This is a big mistake, this book. He is guilty of crimes. And if we had a Justice Department that was doing their job instead of spending...
It's your Justice Department. Mr. President, you're the Republican
you're right.
in charge.
You're
You've
right.
got a Republican
but
running
here's
it.
What I answer this all the time. Because of the fact that they have this witch hunt going on with people in the Justice Department that shouldn't be there, they have a witch hunt against the President of the United States going on, I've taken the position, and I don't have to take this position, and maybe I'll change, that I will not be involved with the Justice Department. I will wait till this is over. It's a total, it's all lies, and it's a horrible thing that's going on, a horrible thing. And yet I've accomplished, with all of this going on, more than any president in the first year in our history.
That's President Trump yesterday on Fox News, talking about how his hands basically are tied behind his back. He's taken the position that, well, I can't meddle in this. And so he hasn't fired Mueller. He hasn't fired Rosenstein. He fired McCabe on the advice of Rosenstein. And he fired Comey. And that was it. But on as far as cleaning house, I mean, how would that be received by his political enemies? He can't even make the mere suggestion to Comey to just, hey, go easy on Flynn. He's a good guy. That's obstruction of justice. He's in a very difficult position. And yet, as he said there, and he's right, he's pressed ahead with some of the key points on his agenda and has accomplished a fair bit over the first year of his presidency. And maybe at some point he will throw caution to the wind and and start cleaning house at the top of these agencies. But he said there, it's because of this witch hunt that was brought on by James Comey's leaks. It's because of this. I mean, that's how close the United States is to, as my father said, well, not being saved or dying, saving America from the radical left. Listen to one final clip from that exchange yesterday. Here's clip 4.
Had I not gotten elected, Hillary would have come in. She would have added more rules and regulations. We would have been out of business because you saw what was happening. We were going down.
Right. Saving America from the radical left temporarily. It's exactly what my father says in the recent Trumpet magazine, where he goes through 2 Kings 14, talks about that example of Jeroboam the second. He wasn't a righteous man by any means. I mean, he carried on in the same traditions of Jeroboam the first, idolatry and such. And yet the Bible says there in 2 Kings 14 that God actually used that unrighteous king to help the nation of Israel, to help to give the nation of Israel a moment of temporary resurgence, growth. He did follow those rebellious traditions of his fathers, but there was a temporary resurgence in Israel because of God's great mercy. All of that history is there for us today, as my father brings out. And when you go back to what he has said in America Under Attack, in Great Again, those two books in particular, and what my father wrote even ahead of the election in November 2016, and then shortly after it, he says in the article, Donald Trump has proved himself willing to take a stand where others have not. It's quite something to behold him resisting these anti-American forces. He has inspired a few other leaders to challenge the radical left and help expose it for what it is. It says when you compare what this president is doing to what his predecessor did, there's been a clear change in direction, one that will slow the speed at which America is being pulled apart. He's not trashing the Constitution, as the previous president did. He's passed tax cuts that will help American families. He's rolled back the universal health care mandate and removed regulations that were hurting American businesses. The stock market's broken new records. We are seeing what I wrote in Great Again, that after President Trump took office, conditions in America may improve for a short time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Nelson Mandela and his presidency starting in 1994, being voted in as president on this day 24 years ago, and we'll look at what has happened to South Africa since. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
After he was elected as South Africa's president in 1994, Nelson Mandela said, our greatest responsibility will be to turn this suffering country into a prosperous, peaceful and democratic society in which there will be jobs, peace, and security for all. Well, that, as it turns out, did not happen, not in the slightest. South Africa has one of the highest murder rates in the world. Some commentators have labeled the nation as the rape capital of the world. Some years ago, there was a survey that found that 1 in 4 South African men admitted to raping someone. 25% of the men, and of those, half of them admitted to raping more than one woman. Rape, crime, murder, robbery, carjackings. That's South Africa today. And of course, Mandela, who, as I said in the first segment, the man who helped bring down the white government back in the early 1990s, he made a lot of promises coming in. He talked about their great responsibility, as I just quoted to you. But he said that South Africa would become a land of milk and honey. It would turn into this Garden of Eden utopia. Mr. Fraser, this history, you can't look at this history without thinking back to the articles that Ron Fraser wrote in the Trumpet magazine there in the mid-1990s, the articles that were then converted into a booklet, South Africa in Prophecy. But right in the early pages of that booklet, Mr. Fraser said, the transition of Nelson Mandela from terrorist to most favored political prisoner, thence in 1994 to president of his country of birth, honored by heads of state worldwide, finally taking a seat of honor beside Queen Elizabeth as they threw the cheering masses in London in July 1996, is one that has few parallels in modern history. I mean, we have not seen something like this. A terrorist who's now held up as the last great liberator of the 20th century. And the truth is, as hard as it is for people to accept, he has not liberated South Africa in any way. A former terrorist transition. This transition, it's seen few parallels in modern history. Margaret Thatcher referred to him and his organization, the ANC, as a typical terrorist organization. That was back in 1987. But she just didn't understand. If you look at what it says, this is the British National Party website, talking about some of this history that many people would rather forget. The fact that Mandela found the military wing of the ANC called the MK comes from words that are translated as Spear of the Nation. That's the military wing he headed up. It says here at this website, the MK committed over 150 public acts of violence and terrorism. Consequently, the numerous bombings killed 63 people and injured 483. Targets included a Jewish synagogue, a black policeman's home, restaurants, shopping centers, pubs, and even a nuclear power plant. It says Nelson Mandela pleaded guilty in court to 156 acts of terrorism and violence. When arrested, Mandela and his fellow terrorists had in their possession a massive stockpile of weapons. That's the history. But people say, well, but he changed. He mellowed out when he was in jail. I mean, he turned into a different individual. And he came out promising such great things for a new South Africa. And he was in power there for 5 or 6 years. And then it passed on to another president. And then here we are 24 years later, almost a full generation. And look at the South Africa of today. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's gotten worse, much worse. all that you're meant to understand is that this was the last great liberator of the 20th century. That's how the world honored him at his funeral in 2014 as one of the great heroes of our day. 90 heads of state. But yet look at South Africa. Aren't we to judge by fruits? What did Nelson Mandela and the ANC party, what have they actually done for the people of South Africa, this nation that has so much crippling poverty, an educational system on the brink of collapse, all of these sexual assaults, the crime epidemic, the AIDS epidemic, the epidemic of rape, murder. The New York Times, this is from last week, or maybe just over the weekend. The New York Times is sounding the alarm. Countries should be measured less against the rest of the world than against their own potential and promise. And on that score, the same African National Congress that Nelson Mandela led to a triumphant victory over apartheid a quarter century ago has become gorged on corruption. I mean, in fact, it was corrupt from the beginning. But now it's so bad, it's so obvious. The corruption runs through and through. Even the New York Times has to acknowledge it. What is particularly galling is that so many of the millions filched from the state coffers were earmarked to lift up the poor left behind by apartheid. While politically connected companies and individuals have grown wealthy, the gap between them and the poor, most of them blacks, has only grown. I mean, this is according to a recent report by the World Bank and the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development. South Africa is one of the most unequal countries in the world. The gap is widening between the rich and the poor because the ones taking all the money are those with connections, connections to the ANC. It says the potential for change was evident when the ANC finally forced President Jacob Zuma out of office in February. Mr. Zuma's 9 years in office were a byword for obscene corruption. And he now faces corruption, racketeering, fraud, and money laundering charges. It talks about his successor, Cyril Ramaphosa. I guess I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but he's coming in with all of these lofty ideals and great promises. We're going to turn this nation into a nation of prosperity where there's plenty of jobs, where we restore law and order. The same old, the same promises that we heard back in 1994. And it just gets worse. This new president, by the way, he campaigned on the point of taking away the farms from the white farmers and giving the land to the blacks. We wrote about this in The Trumpet. There's an article we posted on March 1st, 2018, just this year, a couple months ago. It happened in February. I think Andrew Miller wrote it. I didn't write down the name, but it says the government of South Africa plans to start confiscating white-owned land without compensation, policymakers announced at the 54th National Conference of the African National Congress in December. So here's the new campaign promise coming from Mr. Ramaphosa. He says, we're going to accelerate our land distribution program. We're going to take it from the wealthier farmers and then just give it to the blacks. And it's long overdue. The land redistribution program, not only to redress a grave historical injustice, but also to bring more producers into the agricultural sector and to make more land available for cultivation. Of course, the white farmers, they're looking at what happened in Zimbabwe and panicking. And yet this new president's promising it's not going to be that way. I mean, we know that this has happened before elsewhere, but look, this is just going to open up more farming opportunities. There's going to be more prosperity. Those are always the promises. It says South African Communist Party, the South African Communist Party said it welcomed a policy of expropriation of land without compensation, but it warned that the African National Congress must not just shout populist rhetoric. It must follow through. And so there's more to unfold here, I guess. In August, we learn about how this is going to be carried out. But look, this was passed with an overwhelming majority, this motion. And now at the end of August, we'll find out how that this is going to proceed. And the president's promising that, look, there's not going to be any foul play here. And meanwhile, though, the murder of white farmers continues at a clip of something like 70 or 80 per year. It's one of the most dangerous jobs in South Africa. That's South Africa today. And never mind the history, never mind the fruits, never mind the obscene corruption, to use the words of the New York Times. And never mind what's surely going to happen in South Africa following this land grab. There's one author at the American Thinker. Let me just give you a snippet from his piece. It says, I've been to places where expropriations in the name of the people happened, namely Venezuela. While I was there in late 2005, I specifically asked farmers in the rural in these two rural states to take me to places where land was expropriated in the name of correcting injustice, quote unquote, and empowering the people. The places I was taken were fallow. Well, it uses a term that's a little bit off color. They had gone to seed by their unmotivated leftist comrade masters and their unwilling indigent tenant farmers supposedly benefiting from it in the name of the collective. I remember the ragged red Chavista flag fluttering in the breeze on a hill to mark the shambling, weed-filled disaster as miserable-looking people sat huddled by a tent, doing nothing, which stood in stark contrast to the neatly maintained farm across the road that had yet to be expropriated. I have heard since that they all have been expropriated in the name of social justice. So I can only imagine what a garbage and weed-strewn fallow wasteland it now must be. South Africa has launched itself into the same fate. And there will be weeds, and there will be hunger. You would think, it says, you would think the Zimbabwean example would terrify them. But their rulers are so left-wing, they're so far into this communist thinking that they actually get excited about this. Barack Obama is set to visit South Africa and to set off a project in the summer to, I guess, create this paradise that they all keep talking about, the communists. The New York Times, the same New York Times that talked about how bad it was in South Africa in its April 22nd edition, the very next day, it has this piece about Mr. Obama's forthcoming trip to South Africa, inaugurating his most significant international project as an ex-president, with an announcement on Monday that the Obama Foundation plans to convene 200 young people this July in Johannesburg for 5 days of meetings, workshop, and technical training. It says, at the same time, Mr. Obama will deliver a lecture to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Nelson Mandela, whom he eulogized after his death 5 years ago by saying, "He makes me want to be a better man." This article, it quotes Ben Rhodes. We're familiar with him, the creative speechwriter. Rhodes says it gives Obama an opportunity to lift up a message of tolerance, inclusivity, and democracy at a time when there are obviously challenges to Mandela's legacy around the world. See, it gives him an opportunity to say, listen, he's the last great liberator of the 20th century, and ever since he came to power, it's just been a bed of roses for South Africa. The truth is something far different. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us any feedback, you can send your emails to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.